We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Let's dive in, starting out with local and paid sick leave.
Yes, a proposal was announced this week for a new paid sick leave policy for employers and employees in the city of Seattle. It was announced by a coalition of small business owners, labor groups, and progressives. What the proposal would do if it was passed by the city council is it would create a graduated scale for paid sick leave requirements depending on the size of the business. So it would include up to 5 days per year of paid sick leave for businesses with less than 50 employees. For businesses with less than 249, it would be up to 7 days. And for businesses with less than 1,000, it would be up to 9 days. If you have more than 1,000 employees, the business owner would have to provide an hour of vacation or sick time for every 15 hours worked. And that comes out to be about 17 days of combined paid and vacation time for full-time employees at businesses with over 1,000 employees. But it also includes, I think this is kind of strange, probation period for employees to get this benefit. So at larger companies, employees would have to work 3 months before they can use their sick time. And at smaller companies, they'd have to work a minimum of 6 months in order to use their sick time, which I think is a little bit strange. It does.
Particularly since most small companies don't have that kind of a policy to begin with. A lot of them, you can, if you're sick, you're sick.
It does. Well, it does encourage long-term employee employment relations. However, the problem is a lot of the businesses that supported this policy include and helped to write this policy include a lot of restaurants in town. And in fact, Nick Licata, who is going to be introducing the proposal to the city council, he cited a statistic saying that 30% of foodborne illnesses in King County each year in the past 4 to 5 years are due to employees handling food while they're sick. It's being billed as a public health issue. It's kind of interesting to me because in the food service industry, a lot of people work for 6 months or less at various employers, particularly a lot of people who are temporary workers or who move from job to job because they're young and they're looking for full-time work in their job of choice. They often fall back on food service work. So,
yeah, and honestly, how many people are gonna make a point of working more than 6 months just so they can get the sick leave?
Yeah, so that was kind of troubling, particularly the fact that that smaller employers, you know, are given 6 months before they have to give you any kind of paid sick leave. But on the other hand, it's better than no sick leave at all, I would have to say. So Licata is going to be introducing the proposal to the city council sometime in August. An upcoming public hearing is set for Wednesday, July 6th in the city council chambers. And then on July 13th, the city council's Housing, Human Services, Health and Culture Committee will discuss the proposal and make potential changes to it and possibly vote on it at that time. So if folks want to weigh in on this proposal, they should go to the hearing on July 6th in the city council chambers at, I think it's at 5:30 or 6 p.m., and go and give testimony if the council allows it. I think they probably will.
All right. Moving on. new organization this week, New Approach Washington.
Yeah, New Approach Washington. It's basically the ACLU with some local prominent politicians and other personalities putting forth a new initiative to legalize and regulate marijuana. Now, the group New Approach Washington includes former U.S. Attorney John McKay, Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes, and local travel guru Rick Steves. They're trying to send a bill to legalize marijuana to the state legislature. It would legalize marijuana for people over 21, extend drunk driving laws to marijuana use, and set certain limits for possession of marijuana. It would also authorize the State Liquor Control Board to regulate and license both the production, the growth, and the sale of pot in the state of Washington. And the state would then also be able to tax the sale of marijuana. The group estimates that the state would be able to bring in about $215 million per year. That's a conservative estimate. I think that's on the low end in terms of taxes on marijuana. They're going to have to get about 240,000 signatures statewide in order to put the initiative before the legislature, and then lawmakers would then be able to vote to either approve it directly or send it to the ballot for voters to approve.
Yeah. Then there's a backstory to this, of course. This has been in the works for the last couple of years, and as a result of the schism within the marijuana advocacy community, the grassroots group Sensible Washington has tried for the last couple of years to qualify a ballot directly by initiative without going through the state legislature. During that entire time, it's been an underfunded effort, specifically because the ACLU has not been on board and has been working actively, in fact, or with national funders in the pro-marijuana movement to try and deny Sensible Washington funding. And the crux of the argument has been the ACLU has wanted it to appear on the ballot in 2012 during a presidential election, during a higher turnout year, thinking that has a better chance of success than either 2010 or 2011. And Sensible Washington's argument has been, look, the number of people who are being thrown in jail every year, the polling shows that this would pass right now. Why not try and get it passed right now? The ACLU, with its access to bigger names and more resources, has a better chance of getting this passed in 2012. Sensible Washington is still trying to get it passed on the ballot this year, but it's looking at this point, at least from the number of signatures they've collected so far, like it probably will not be on the ballot on 2011. So it looks like this will probably be where it shifts, and we're looking at next year rather than this year for this to be resolved. Now, it's not entirely clear, even with the additional money and so forth, that there's going to be no opposition to the ACLU initiative within the marijuana advocacy community. Initially, anyway, the most controversial part of this is the DUI requirements, because there is no real clear legal way or clear scientific way, that is, to measure marijuana impairment the way there is for alcohol, because the level of THC in the blood stays long after any impairment function has seeded it. It stays in the blood much longer than alcohol does. So that's going to be an issue, but nonetheless, this will almost certainly be on the ballot in 2012, because the legislature almost certainly is not going to pass it on their own.
All right. Moving on, a new study regarding bike lanes.
Yeah, a study by the University of Massachusetts was released this week showing that bike lanes create jobs. The study showed that among all of the different types of projects that they studied, bike lanes were the best at creating jobs. They looked at 58 projects in 11 cities in the United States, including the city of Seattle. And here's what they found. They found that bicycle infrastructure, particularly bike lanes, create the most jobs of any transportation infrastructure project that they studied. For each $1 million spent, they create 11.4 jobs. They also looked at pedestrian-only projects, which create 10 jobs for every $1 million spent. They looked at combination projects like bike and pedestrian and bike and car, etc. Those combination projects create a little over 9 jobs per $1 million spent. And then they looked at road-only projects. Those create the fewest jobs, 7.8 jobs per $1 million spent. And if you're asking how can this be, that bike lanes are more efficient at creating jobs, the answer is pretty simple. Bike projects are cheaper than car projects.
Much cheaper.
Much, much cheaper. So you're getting a lot more value for your money. And there's the multi-use nature of bike lanes and trails. They can be used for commuting, and they can be used for running errands, for recreation, for fitness, and most importantly, for tourism. How many tourists yearn to drive on new roads? Not very many. Tourists often will come to town and say, gosh, here's this attractive bike trail. Let's rent a bike. Let's go ride. That creates jobs. Locals will do the same on their day off, on a weekend, on a three-day weekend, often just during the week after work. And the same is true of attractive transit projects, like, for example, the Link Light Rail, the monorail, which exists pretty much solely at this point for tourists to use, and the South Lake Union Trolley, which is pretty much for tourist use as well.
It's for T-shirt sales is what it is.
Yeah. So I found that to be a very interesting study.
All right. Let's move on to national and tax amnesty.
Yes, U.S. corporations are taking advantage of the federal budget negotiations to push for a tax amnesty on their foreign profits. So, for example, a company like Apple has something like $12 billion in foreign profits sitting in cash in accounts offshore that they want to bring home to the U.S. Google has something like $17 billion, and Microsoft, for example, has $29 billion. They call this a repatriation holiday. What it means is that the U.S. government, if Congress passes this as part of the budget negotiations, would reduce the 35% tax rate on corporate profits to 5.25% for 1 year on foreign profits brought home to the United States. So these corporations are dangling a carrot of about $50 billion in additional taxes for the budget. However, if those profits were to be taxed at the full tax rate of 35%, that would be $333 billion. And I want to just point out that that is more than the $200 billion that Congress wants to cut from this next year's federal budget. Now, how can these corporations possibly justify a tax amnesty? Well, they say that if they are allowed to bring their profits home and bring home most of that cash, they would use that cash to provide jobs. Well, I just want to say
You hit the laugh track, Mike.
Yes.
I didn't have it queued up. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
I just want to say that, no, that is not what they will do with the cash. And we know this because the last tax amnesty that Congress passed was in 2005. In 2005, companies brought home $312 billion. I just want to point out that the amount that they would bring home this year, if a tax amnesty were to be passed, would be more than three times that. It'd be closer to $1 trillion. Companies brought home $312 billion in 2005. 92% of that money, 92% of that money was used to buy back stock and pay higher dividends to shareholders. So it was given to shareholders. It was not used to create jobs. It was not used for research costs. It was not used for equipment purchases. In addition, 60% of the benefits of that tax amnesty in 2005 went to 15 of the largest U.S. corporations, many of which laid off U.S. workers and closed plants here in the United States, and then they moved that capacity overseas, which is why their profits are now three times, their foreign profits are now three times what they were in 2005.
I have another question about this, too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, say I'm a corporate accountant and I'm trying to figure out, you know, what to do with our assets and whether to hold them overseas out of range of the taxes or to have them here. If I can count on the idea that every few years there's going to be a tax amnesty on overseas tax shelters, why wouldn't I make it? In other words, if this becomes an ongoing policy that every few years we're going to have one of these, wouldn't that act as an incentive
to
have corporations
absolutely.
Go overseas? Counting on the fact that in the long term they're going to have a much lower tax rate because they'll be able to bring them back and repatriate them and give the money to their shareholders anyway.
Absolutely. And then the risk becomes that this gets enshrined in U.S. tax law, that foreign profits will always be taxed at a lower tax rate in order to bring the cash home or encourage companies to bring the cash home. That's the major risk here. And so I think folks need to be contacting their Congress people and urging them to veto or to vote down any amendment made to any budget bill that includes a tax amnesty for corporations.
All right. Moving on. Several Supreme Court decisions this week, starting with Walmart.
Yeah, a 5-4 decision. Again, like the decision we talked about last week, again, it's mostly the conservatives on the court.
Entirely, actually.
In favor of...
It was 5-4.
Yes, in favor of Walmart, a class action suit that was brought by female employees of various Walmarts around the nation, claiming that Walmart engaged in employment discrimination against women as a class. The Supreme Court ruled that
I love this logic.
Right, that it was 1.5 million women. The Supreme Court ruled that the women did not have status as a class. That the attorneys could not show that in spite of showing that there were statistics proving that women as a group in Walmarts around the nation had been discriminated against in terms of pay, in terms of promotion, in terms of training and education and movement into managerial positions, the conservative justices on the court did not believe that that meant that these women were being discriminated against because of their gender.
The actual logic was that because Walmart does not have an anti-discrimination policy on the basis of gender, therefore women have no standing as a gender to sue, saying that that policy was not being enforced.
Actually, they had a policy. It was very vague. It said, we do not discriminate in cases of gender, but we do allow our store managers to make up their own decisions and to have their own discretion in terms of hiring, firing, promotion, yeah, pay raises, et cetera.
And that loophole is what got them out.
Yeah. In essence, the court justices said because there wasn't a specific policy and there wasn't a specific since the parent company hadn't laid out a plan for managers to use when they do hiring, firing, promotions, pay raises, etc., then they can't prove that the company engaged in discrimination against women, in spite of the fact that the court said that, yes, we do have to look at the proof of we do have to look at the merits of the case, these very same statistics, to decide whether or not a class exists and the case can go forward. To me, that's a major contradiction. Yeah. If you're going to look at the statistics in the case and say, yes, the case can go forward, but then you're going to say, oh, no, the class doesn't exist because the statistics in the case don't bear it out, to me, that's a major contradiction.
Yeah. It's very similar, if you can imagine, to the Supreme Court deciding sometime in the 1960s that, Jim Crow is not unconstitutional because if you have an employer, for example, that has restaurants all over the South that doesn't hire people of color.
Yeah.
But there's no policy that says that they don't hire people of color.
And you can't.
Therefore, it's not a problem.
Yeah, and you can't prove that it was racism that was the cause. That's what the justices said, you know. So you're looking at this going, okay, women are discriminated against in terms of pay, but you're saying, what? It's not based on gender. It's based on what? Eye color? It's based on the fact that they wear makeup? What are you talking about?
Chromosomes. It's based on chromosomes, not gender.
What are you talking about? It was just very obviously a bad ruling.
Yeah. Right. And there were other rulings this week.
Yes, there were. Twin Supreme Court decisions saying, first of all, that generic drug makers for Big Pharma do not have to warn consumers about newly discovered risks or side effects on their products, and that in the second ruling, that consumers can't sue them if they don't warn about those risks. Once again, a 5-4 decision with the 5 conservative Supreme Court justices. Once again, a very pro-corporate decision, and once again, no real recourse to it. And these kind of decisions are just going to keep happening until the composition of the Supreme Court changes, and that might be a while.
Yeah.
All right. And finally, a national nuclear-related update.
Yeah, there was an AP story this week regarding radioactive leaks from U.S. nuclear plants. Tritium leaks from 48 of 65 nuclear sites have occurred in most of them. Two-thirds, I believe, in the past 5 years, according to Nuclear Regulatory Commission records reviewed by the Associated Press. Leaks from 37 of these contained concentrations of tritium that exceed the EPA's drinking water standards, some of them at hundreds of times the limit. But more disturbing is where the leaks came from. The leaks come from underground water pipes that carry coolant water for the plants in case of an emergency in order to prevent a meltdown. That points to the problem of corroded pipes, many not even inspected since they were installed 30 to 40 years ago. And I want to just point out that these, of course, in these aging, failing reactors, 66 U.S. reactors have been approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for 20-year extensions to their original 40-year licenses, and 16 more are pending review. And many of those that have been approved are ones that have had these tritium leaks and obviously have corroded pipes in their emergency coolant systems. Meanwhile, at Fukushima, a water filtration system that was meant to purify the huge amounts of water that are being radioactive water that's being collected there had to be shut down after only 5 hours of operation because one of the filters had filled up with radioactive cesium. This filter was supposed to last for several weeks, not for just 5 hours, which means that radiation levels at Fukushima are obviously higher, much higher than are being reported, and possibly higher than can be measured. Also this week, the UN Nuclear Atomic Energy Agency had said that they wanted international stress tests of nuclear reactors in sites around the world, and you can better believe that the U.S. government is going to fight that proposal.
All right. Moving on, President Obama's speech this week on Afghanistan.
Yeah, President Obama gave a speech on Wednesday talking about withdrawal from Afghanistan. It was extremely underwhelming. He announced a 10,000 troop withdrawal by the end of the year. I want to point out that that is one-tenth of the 100,000 troops that are there right now. In addition, he talked about withdrawing 20,000 more troops by next summer, leaving 70% of the troops that are there now still in the country at the end of 12 months.
And still more troops than he inherited in 2009.
Absolutely. And then the rest, he said, would slowly leave by the year 2014. That's if Obama is reelected. More shocking is the cost of the war. It was announced this week that the war in Afghanistan is going to cost about $120 billion in the year 2011 alone. It was also announced that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq had reached the $1 trillion expense through May, which I want to just say is laughable. I would say it's at least double that. And if you count all of the money that is budgeted to be spent in Iraq and Afghanistan for the rest of this year, all the money being spent on intelligence costs, on VA costs, on disability costs for vets. If you talk about all of the money that's been spent and going to be spent in Afghanistan and Iraq on the reconstruction projects, including all the money that's been lost and embezzled, it is far over the $2 trillion mark.
And in fact, I would add that in 2006, Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, made an estimate that the cost in Iraq alone of those kind of long-term costs was $3 to $5 trillion.
Yeah.
So you can imagine what that and Afghanistan look like 45 years later.
Yeah, going forward. And I just want to point out as a point of comparison, $2 trillion is what is Congress's goal for budget cuts over the next decade to try to bring the federal budget into balance. That's a comparison figure for you.
All right. Also this week, big fight or a fight brewing over the War Powers Act.
Yeah, the House of Representatives, as we mentioned last week, has been trying, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives has been trying to hold the president accountable for not invoking the War Powers Resolution after 60 days had passed with the U.S. Involvement in NATO hostilities in Libya, rather. Now, mind you, it's sort of the height of hypocrisy on both sides here. On the Republican side, many of the same people who are now claiming to be doves and that the administration does not have the power to go into Libya were themselves doing apologetics over much worse abuses in the Bush administration around Afghanistan and Iraq. On the other hand, the Obama administration is claiming that the War Powers Resolution does not apply, and the reason it doesn't apply is the U.S. is not actually involved in hostilities in Libya, which is a semantic game that nobody buys. Anyway, that came to a vote in the House of Representatives this week, and in the state of Washington's delegation, it was a strict party-line vote. All of the Democrats, including alleged peaceniks like Jim McDermott, voted with the Obama administration, saying that it's just fine for the president to commit the U.S. to war as long as we don't call it war, and all of the Republicans, all of whom certainly, and that includes Dave Reichert on the East Side, all of whom supported the Bush administration's war in Iraq, voted against extending the War Powers Resolution to the Obama administration. So very much politics, very much partisan, very much with no regard for the actual merits of the question, let alone the people who are caught in the crossfire of yet another war in the Middle East.
Mm.
Meanwhile, speaking of people caught in the crossfire of the war, a report from the UN High Commissioner for Refugees this week, a study saying that nearly half of the world's refugees come from United States-initiated wars, specifically in Afghanistan and Iraq, over 3 million in Afghanistan and 1.7 million in Iraq. Neither the U.S. nor the rest of the developed world, according to the UNHCR, bearing the burden of the 10.5 million total refugees under the UNHCR's purview. Instead, the leading countries, host countries for those refugees, all of whom are in the third world, include Pakistan, Iran, and Syria.
All right. And also a UN report out this week on the state of the oceans.
Yeah, a very, very alarming report this week from the International Program on the State of the Ocean, saying that ocean life is, this is a direct quote, at high risk of entering a phase of extinction of marine species unprecedented in human history. What they found was that the combination of overfishing, pollution, and climate change are all reinforcing each other in previously unrecognized ways to dramatically accelerate what was previously thought to be the rate of extinction and the rate of acidification of the oceans and any number of other things that are also contributing to species extinction. They're calling it a mass extinction event to be very likely at this point, and compared to the other five events that have happened in the history of biology on this planet, at least that we know of, far faster than any of those other previous events, and definitely human-caused.
Yeah.
All right. Events.
Well, this weekend is Pride Weekend, and a good weekend for it, too, given the New York State's decision yesterday to legalize gay marriage. So it'll be a lot of celebration this week. Today is Capitol Hill Pride, and also tonight the Seattle Dyke March, rally happening from 5 to 7 o'clock at the SCCC Plaza at Broadway and Pine, and then the march at 7. And then tomorrow is the Pride Parade downtown, starting from 4th and Union at 11 o'clock and going to Seattle Center, and then Pride Fest all day.
Yeah,
so go
and
check it out.
And bring your sign saying congratulations, New York, for passing a gay marriage law there.
Yeah, biggest state to do it so far, and that raises the obvious question, why can't we do it here in Washington State?
If New York can, why can't we?
Yeah, I always got to like it when people make their own signs, regardless of what they are. Talking, as we do every week, with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State, and where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org, and story we didn't have time to get to this week, but commenting there on the city's efforts to close down Autonomia, the anarchist community center and the CD, and some other stuff. Go check it out.
We still got a minute left. Go ahead and talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, the city's Department of Neighborhoods and Planning, I believe it is. No, that's the wrong acronym. Anyway, city department issued a notice this week for an anarchist center that opened up in March. There's been some conflicts there between the center, which is not in a residential zoned area, taking over the space of a former convenience store. The city is claiming that it's acting as a nightclub, that it's been holding concerts there, etc. And so there's a conflict there, but the conflict has been exacerbated by a couple things. Number one, they're anarchists, so they probably haven't applied for the proper permits. But secondly, the word anarchist seems to freak some people out, because it's an underfunded effort. They are making an effort to, at least according to the interviews and the story in the Post Globe where this first appeared, they are making efforts to try and soundproof the place. There's been a relatively small number of neighborhood comments, and so it's one of these interesting conflicts where both ideology and bureaucracy are colliding.